what every American needs to know about the Fed and central banking. Hi, Ted Anderson. I will give a U.S. silver dollar to everyone who purchases this book. Call 800-686-2237. It's critical to be made aware of the system. Get your copy today, 800-686-2237. That's 800-686-2237.
As the old saying goes, if you give a man a fish, you feed him for a day. But if you give him a Berkey system, you give him the ability to obtain purified water for a lifetime. This year, when giving Christmas gifts, instead of unwanted trinkets, give a meaningful and substantial gift. Berkey systems are ideal for every member of your family, especially the young ones in college. Unlike other water filtration systems, Berkey purifiers are portable. They require no plumbing, and the elements don't have to be replaced every 4 to 6 months. Perfect for anyone on a tight budget, and more importantly, if there's an unexpected emergency, your loved ones will be prepared. That's because Berkey systems are able to purify raw, untreated water. Check out our Christmas specials at BerkeyWater.com. With one of our quantity specials, you not only get a discount, but...
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you of the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Dr. Dennis Cuddy, who's taught at the college level, who's worked in the Reagan administration, Department of Education, who's lectured before Congress, who's served as an analyst for a number of corporations through the world. A wonderful source of information. You can read his articles, which are regularly published at newswithviews.com. That's newswithviews.com. But without further ado, Dr. Dennis Cuddy. Hi, thank you so very much for being with us today, Dennis. Oh, you've got to push the button here to get him on. Thank you so very much for being with us, Dennis.
Thanks for having me.
Well, why don't you pick up the charade? We're going to continue with your analysis. It sounds like the CIA is being very active today.
They're interrupting us.
They are, right. Go right ahead.
Well, this is the Rockefeller Plan, Part 5. I've gone through various elements of this educational, economic, spiritual, religious in the past. And the overall idea here would be to show how a member or members of the power elite actually operate. They're not just exclusively economic. People think of the name of Rockefeller as associated with maybe banking and oil, but as I've been pointing out in this series, they're into far more than that. And so this is the second part of a political New World Order plan that they have. Other areas before. As usual, at the beginning of these columns that I have with News with Views, there is a about some sort of recent issue. And in this case, I'm just providing a warning here. A few months ago, Barack Obama, when he was campaigning in Colorado, said, quote, "We've got to have a civilian national security force that's just as powerful, just as strong, just as well funded as the military." And many people would look at that and as a standalone comment.
Now that sounds like Hitler's brown shirts. We're getting a lot of interference. Something's happening. I'm going to have my secretary call you right back. Is that all right? You hang up, and maybe we can get a better line, or maybe the CIA won't be able to be on that line, okay?
Okay.
If you hang up, we'll call, have our producer call just once more and see if we can get Dennis Cuddy back. But very often, certainly, in my estimation, Dr. Cuddy is certainly the finest researcher we have in the United States. And I do notice, for whatever reason, very often when we have him on, and never when we have anybody else on, but when we have Dr. Dennis Cuddy on, we get all of this interference. I'm sure it's just a coincidence. I'm sure that the people, powers that be, would not want to silence his message or keep you from hearing him, but let's see if we can just do a little bit better by calling back again. So let's go ahead, and we've got Dr. Cuddy back on. Dr. Cuddy, go right ahead.
Okay. Well, what I said was about the Civilian National Security Force that President-elect at the time, Barack Obama, said we should have. And you had mentioned it sounds very much like the brown shirts. And the reason one wants to not only look at that, but also at what his new attorney general, Eric Holder, said some years ago, is that if you put the two things together, it becomes rather ominous. And what Holder said on NBC's This Week back May 2nd of 1999 is he said that the Second Amendment talks about bearing arms in a well-regulated militia, and he said, I don't think anywhere it talks about an individual.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay. Our guest this afternoon is our good friend Dr. Dennis Cuddy, who's taught at the university level and served in the Reagan administration and testified before Congress and has done all sorts of research for various companies through the years. But right now he's doing research on a regular basis and helping us. So go right ahead. We're talking about certainly the whole idea that Barack Obama has talked about the necessity for a civilian force that will be equally well-funded and equipped as the military. And what he's basically talking about is the brown shirts like Adolf Hitler had. Remember that Mr. Obama is a socialist. He's a dedicated socialist, and that's what the Nazi Germany was all about, was national socialism. There is no place in the Constitution where we have any justification even for a federal police force. The CIA is not authorized in the Constitution. The FBI is not authorized in the Constitution. And certainly brown shirts are not authorized. And yet there are people in Washington, D.C. today who have an entirely different picture. They want an all-powerful totalitarian state where, of course, the people are disarmed and everybody is subservient to our new ruler. So go right ahead, Dennis.
Sure, and when you put that together with what his now Attorney General Eric Holder said on ABC's This Week back in 1999, when he was talking about the Second Amendment only applies to a well-regulated militia, not to individuals, then what you have to ask yourself is if you can envision Obama's civilian national security force actually coming down your street and knocking on your door and asking you to turn over any weapons you may have. And what would you do in that situation? Is the Civilian National Security Force, the Attorney General now believes you have no right as an individual to bear arms. Can you see the possible consequences of this?
And, you know, I think what's really so exciting is that the state of New Hampshire has said if they try to impose this, New Hampshire is going to withdraw from the Union because, and they passed a resolution to this effect, that the federal government has violated the Constitution, and states all across America are doing this. The information is being totally blocked out by the controlled media. You can go up on the Internet and, of course, Google it in and find out, but you will never hear through the regular media and the controlled media the truth. The fact that people all across America are concerned about the impending dictatorship. At least we have the Internet and we have alternative radio. The people of Germany didn't have this in the 1930s. We do have it. The question is, are there enough Americans who really value freedom that they're willing to take a stand? And so go right ahead, Dennis.
Right. And
Hold that thought. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and go right ahead, Dennis.
Okay, and then the second item I have under my beginning note for this column is, and I just mentioned this because we've talked about it before, but apparently now there's real proof of this. Many times in the past, and I've known this for many years, about the Lusitania actually containing armaments when the Germans, they tried to post an ad in American newspapers. I think the Des Moines Register was the one that had it, warning people not to go on that ship because it really had arms. And over all these decades and decades, the American government, the British government, denied it. However, there was an American firm that got the rights to it. They finally went down. They have the capability now of going down to the sunken ship. And so if you look at the London Daily Mail of December 20 of just this past year, 2008, and look at the article titled "Secret of Lusitania, Arms Find Challenges, Allied Claims It Was Solely a Passenger Ship," end quote. They actually found the bullets and a lot of other things. So what people suspected has now really been proven, that this was a setup to get America into the war. The British knew exactly what they were doing that morning at 11:30 a.m.
But so did our American State Department. What people have to understand is that eventually, of course, William Jennings Bryan, who was the Secretary of State, made sure that those articles got published, at least in some of our newspapers, by the Germans, who said, "We're going to sink the Lusitania. Do not allow Americans to go on there." And people contacted the State Department, who said, "Oh, you've got nothing to worry about. You just go right ahead and get on the Lusitania." And 109 Americans died, but it was just like 9/11. You remember, of course, the people in the South Tower, after the North Tower had been attacked, the people in the South Tower were told over the public address system, "Stay at your desks, don't get up. You've got nothing to worry about, stay at your desk." And fortunately, at least, in where Morgan Stanley was, the chief of security ran up and down the aisle with a megaphone and said, "Get out, get out, get out, we're under attack." And he saved 2,400 lives. They intended for them to die, just like they intended the people on the Lusitania to die. Colin Simpson wrote a wonderful book called The Lusitania. I hadn't heard about them going down and actually uncovering the shipwreck, but I think it's so vitally important people understand. They intended for the people on the Lusitania to die. Why? So they could get America into World War I and kill a lot of Americans. And, of course, that was the idea of the war to end all wars, to bring about the League of Nations and to make the world safer, the democracy. Those were the two slogans. The war to make the world safer, democracy. The war to end all wars. It was exactly what's going on today, this desire to create a world government. And, of course, they had to have the Second World War, too. That's how they created the League of Nations, and that's why they're going to have a Third World War, of course, to once and for all establish their world government, which is the major occultic motive behind so much of what's going on. Dennis, you go right ahead.
Okay. Years before, with the Admiralty, Winston Churchill had actually conducted a study of what America's reaction would be if a passenger liner was sunk with American passengers on board. They did that for a reason, and then in my books I put, I think it was in The Globalist, I not only put about Robert Lansing, if any of you people have The Globalist, you can look in there for Robert Lansing's attitude toward all of this, and you can also see an entry that is 11:30 a.m. on that morning, May 7th, Colonel House, Woodrow Wilson's chief advisor, is over at Buckingham Palace, and the king actually asked House there, he says, what do you think would happen if the Lusitania were sunk with American passengers on board? And then, sure enough, 3.5 hours later, guess what happens?
In fact, I actually have that the diary. I think it was actually Lord Escher's diary where this was all brought out. It was all a setup. They knew they were going to die. They wanted them to die. That was how they were going to get us into the war. In fact, in that Lord Escher's diary, and for those of you who don't know, Lord Escher was one of the original four members of Cecil Rhodes' secret occult society intent upon bringing about a world government. Today it has a front organization, works in the United States at 5080 68th Street in New York City. It's called the Council on Foreign Relations. If you want to check out the fact that it's a front for Cecil Rhodes Secret Society, it's on page 952 of Professor Quigley's book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, which is why that book was suppressed for so many years. And somebody came in and bought up the publisher, Macmillan, and then destroyed the place to the first half of the book. They can't let the American people realize, of course, that the Council on Foreign Relations, which, of course, almost so many of our presidents have belonged to, or the vice presidents, which, of course, now is sort of a farm club for the Trilateral Commission. This whole thing, you know, dates back to a secret society that was created in 1891 by Cecil Rhodes to unify the world. But you go right ahead, Dennis.
Okay, let me make a suggestion, sort of a clarification, just a tad, I think, on what you just said there. I believe what you'll find about the Buckingham Palace will be in the annual papers of Colonel House, I believe, by Charles Seymour, who is a Skull and Bones member, and so on. The Escher diary is where you'll find him and Morgenthau saying we have to shed American blood as soon as possible to get France, to get Woodrow Wilson steadied, and to shore up the French support, because J.P. Morgan's fellow Robert Bacon with Hanotaux had been pressuring the French to get into the war, which the French did not want to do, but they said, you get in there and we'll bring America in, and you know, sure enough they did. I think those will be the two. The Escher diaries is the one where you'll find that Morgenthau meeting about shedding blood.
All right, fine. Go ahead. All
right. Now, as that's the end of the note. Now, beginning with the column, the Rockefeller Plan, part five, regarding the political and New World Order element, I've mentioned before several times about David Rockefeller's admission in his book memoirs in 2002 about being part of a secret cabal working against the best interests of the U.S. and conspiring with others around the world to build a more integrated global political and economic structure, one world, if you will. And we've talked about that many times. What I thought was of particular interest is that I said, well, you know, I want to be sure, because I hadn't seen any acknowledgement by the New York Times, Washington Post, ABC, NBC, whoever, about this. So I said, well, surely the New York Times had a book review. So I went back and hunted up the book review. It was a really long one by the alleged conservative David Brooks. And it was a very long review, and I read the whole thing, and it was October 20, 2002, their book review section. And not a peep about that remarkable admission was in there. Now, you know, you got to wonder, how could he miss this? I mean, the title of the chapter is Proud Internationalist. And this is like on the second page, the first page of the chapter begins, it was a great day at the CFR. And then the next page, it goes on with this admission. But golly shucks, I guess David Brooks and the New York Times just didn't happen to see that.
In fact, listeners, we do carry David Rockefeller's memoirs in our from Radio Liberty. We want you to read what he says about how, of course, some people say he's part of a secret cabal that is, or the Rockefeller family is part of a secret cabal that's conspiring against the best interests of the United States and wants to bring about an international order. And if that is the charge, I am guilty. That's David Rockefeller's word. He is the man who organized the Trilateral Commission, the permanent chairman of the honorary chairman of the Council on Foreign Relations, an original member, founding member of the Bilderbergers, been there for 50 years. This little group of people who controls the wealth of the world. Go right ahead.
And when I brought that up some time ago, it was years ago, to a fellow with USA Today, in the past, anyway, over 30 articles on the USA Today's editorial page. So I called up a guy who wrote a column on George Bush and Skull and Bones and said, well, maybe this guy will be interested, you know, in publicizing this and exposing this. And he would hem and haw, oh, he was kidding, oh. And I said, kidding? You got to be kidding. The title of the chapter is Proud Internationalist, and he's saying, if that's the charge, I stand guilty and I'm proud of it. I mean, do you think the whole chapter is just one big yuck? You think the publisher is printing a volume that's supposed to be the memoirs, the culmination of a life of David Rockefeller? They say, hey, what the heck? Let's have 30 pages of, you know, one big joke? I don't think so.
Well, Dennis, the reason, of course, that they're not going to publish that in U.S. News and World Report is because Mr. Zuckerman, who is the owner and editor of U.S. News and World Report, just happens to be one of the 87 American members of the North American chapter of the Trilateral Commission. And just exactly the same people who control the Newsweek magazine and the Washington Post. They're not going to, of course, tell you the truth. They're part of the cabal that runs this country, and the last thing they want is for the American people to understand that there's this subversive cabal, of course, that is intent upon the destruction of our freedom. But for the listener out there, you can get the membership list at augustreview.org, or, as I do, you go to their website, trilateral.org. You've got to email them and ask them for the membership list. They'll send it to you. But, of course, the average American's never going to even hear about it, because they control the major media. And, of course, the last thing they want is that for people to know that there's a cabal that's created the financial collapse of our nation, has created wars and revolutions and terrible suffering for the last century. Go ahead.
Yeah, mentioning the last entry, and then we had mentioned previously about the New York Times. Most of my books, I try to interject as little of my opinion as possible. I try to put people's own words and what they say and where and the date and so forth. So in my volumes, you'll find, for example, Herman Dinsmore, about 50 years ago, from 1951 to 1960, was the international editor of the New York Times. And in this book that he wrote after that, called All the News That Fits, not All the News That's Fit to Print, but All the News That Fits, he flat out acknowledged that they had squashed any information negative about communists, Castro, whatever, you know. They just, you know, we won't print that stuff. You know, let's portray them in a very positive light.
In fact, I knew Herman Dinsmore. He stayed at my dinner, my home one time many, many years ago. He was a very courageous individual. And eventually he left his employment. He traveled across the country trying to make the people aware. And, of course, everything he did was blocked out by the controlled media, because we have freedom of press. You own the press. You have the freedom to suppress whatever you want. Our guest is Dr. Dennis Cuddy. We're going to be back here in just a moment to explore the most recent article at newswithviews.com. That's newswithviews.com, about the Rockefellers, who are really the most powerful family in the world here, but they're never going to tell you that, not in the controlled media. Go right ahead.
Okay, so what we have here is the Rockefellers and the Rockefeller Plan, and they're moving forward with this political New World Order agenda. And I've described back in the 50s how they used that term. We have to form this New World Order and its various aspects. And just like people, if they read the book 1984 with George Orwell, in there the hero, Winston, is telling O'Brien, Big Brother's agent, that people will never succumb to this. And O'Brien says, yeah, what if we quicken the tempo of human life and so on. What you have here is the Americans say, well, we'll never succumb to this, you know, Rockefeller plan of this secret cabal trying to do this, that, and the other in this global integrated political and economic order. Okay, what you have to understand is these people have these long-range plans, you know, step by step and very, very intricate. And so that's why David Rockefeller, for example, years ago praised Chairman Mao. I mean, he didn't spend a lot of time, you know, praising Brezhnev and Khrushchev and so on, but he was praising Chairman Mao 35-some years ago in the New York Times, that August 10th, 1973 New York Times article, which we don't have to go into again, but the point is that helped to open the door to communist China. Now, why would he want to do that? What they needed to do was increase the economic and military power of the communist Chinese. And if you look, you know, run 35-some years forward to today, more recently, President Bush's Treasury Secretary, Henry Paulson, continuing this effort, he had traveled to China some 70 times in the past. And when he got into Secretary of the Treasury position, he actually started what was called the U.S.-China Strategic Cooperation and Communication Initiative. Now, it's no accident that Paulson was formerly with Goldman Sachs, which just happens to financially represent China and the U.S. in some rather important areas.
In fact, it just so happens that the president of Goldman Sachs just happens by chance to be one of the 87 Americans in the Northern American chapter of the Trilateral Commission. Isn't that a coincidence?
Right. So the CFR member Paulson was recently, of course, just before Bush left office, he was recently given authority by Congress to use these TARP funds, that's the Emergency Economic Stabilization Act, money any way he saw fit. Oh, it's an emergency. We got to do it. Well, what are you going to use? Never mind. Just give me the money and trust me.
But Dennis, he really told Congress. He went before the public. I remember him, and he said, this is not to bail out Wall Street. This is not to bail out Wall Street. This is to bail out Main Street. And he promised that he was going to use this to buy up the mortgages so people wouldn't be losing their homes. But Barney Frank, who's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, who wrote this this obscene legislation, I think it's about 175 pages, just forgot to put in the legislation that the money had to be used to buy up their foreclosed mortgages. So, and Henry Paulson said, you know, he wrote an article in the New York Times on the 18th of November, which he said, I have always said that the major cause of this whole financial collapse is the mortgages, the faulty mortgages that are being cascading, they're collapsing. But if you really believe that, why didn't he try to do something? Why did he give the money to his friends on Wall Street and then forget to put in there a stipulation that they were supposed to lend the money? And they did lend the money. They lent it to Chinese, to the Spanish. They lent it to the Europeans. But Henry Paulson just forgot. He just forgot to put in a stipulation that had to be lent in the United States of America. We'll be right back. And this is Dr. Stan and Dr. Cuddy simply talking about how Henry Paulson got the TARP funds on October 3rd of last year. And, of course, they were to be spent to try to stop the cascade of collapse of mortgages. Right now, 10,000 people in America every day get a notice of foreclosure. And Henry Paulson could have stopped it 4.5 months ago, and he absolutely refused to do it, even though he had written in the New York Times on the 18th of November of last year that the collapse of the housing market was the cause of the collapse, and yet he steadfastly refused to do anything. And you have to ask yourself, why? Go right ahead.
Sure, and his buddy Barney, when asked about it, says, well, you know, you just can't force people to do stuff. Like, you know, that's not what laws do all the time. And so if one reads Dr. Stan's fine newsletter on this subject, Dr. Stan and Radio Liberty, Dr. Stan points out that Bank of America used $7 billion of their loan from Paulson to buy an interest in a Chinese bank, and Citigroup used $10 billion to buy 44 Spanish toll roads. You know, as though the Spanish don't have enough people who operate the toll roads in this country as it is. So the question immediately then arises, how's any of that supposed to help the homeowners in the U.S. Not default on their mortgages, like Dr. Stan says, and I put in my article, well, it's not, you know. And where are we now in 2009? Along the same lines that the Rockefeller plan, when it began, had as his objective. The Chinese are poised now economically to begin to coerce the U.S. to restructure our education and economy in order to compete successfully globally. Now, people point over to China and they're having to lay off workers and so forth, and that's true, but you got to remember, this is very, very minor. It's 1.2, 1.3 billion people. It's a dictatorship. When they have to, you know, shut down a factory, it's no big deal to them, because they have this long-range, overarching objective, which is very, very patient. So it's not like, oh my goodness, you know, the Chinese economy is being destroyed. It's not that at all. What you have is a situation globally where everybody is being played by this power elite. And so what you have is the economic, the Chinese poised, as I said, to coerce us into restructuring. Now, how does this work? Well, if you look at the national news recently, it was reported that a company in China named BYD, Auto Company of China, would introduce soon its electric car. And this electric car is simply you plug it in at night for 7 hours in the morning. It's good to go for 60 miles. You can't, you know, travel across country, but it's good for in town. You just plug it into a wall socket. And it's coming out globally in about 6 months or so. They're not going to let it in the U.S. immediately for very good reasons. But globally, elsewhere, it'll be available. It's mass-produced in about 6 or 7 months. So they went to an auto industry analyst, and he said about the people in Detroit. There are people in Detroit who are, quote, sweating bullets, quote, over this, because BYD's cars will only cost $22,000 each compared to the first American electric car when it comes out a few months after that, because that car, the American car, will cost about $40,000 when it's introduced. Now, here's Detroit spending tons and tons and tons of money to develop this, and lo and behold, just as they're developing the thing, they find out that the Chinese are coming out with their model, which is only half the cost. You can imagine what the guy said. They're sweating bullets because here's their future. They see a big market in the future for this, and lo and behold, all of that research could be down the tubes if people opt for the Chinese BYD car.
But, of course, the thing is, General Motors is either the first or the second largest automobile manufacturer in communist China today. They're shifting their manufacturing to Russia. They're shifting their manufacturing to Brazil. They're shifting their manufacturing to China. And they're saying, oh, you've got to give us more money here in the United States so we can develop our automotive plants over the rest of the world. No, they don't say that. Oh, my goodness, we go bankrupt. Why is it going to impact on the economy? Yet the only way they could actually preserve General Motors would be to go into bankruptcy, to shut off their union contracts. But they're not interested in staying here. And, of course, they're working very, very closely with the Chinese communist companies. But they can't let the American people know that, or the fact that they are intentionally shifting their manufacturing overseas as a means of impoverishing the American people, because there is a master plan. And you have to understand is to shift our manufacturing overseas. That's why, of course, when they passed this so-called stimulus bill and Congress had said, you know, a stipulation for Buy American, and Barack Obama said, absolutely, Buy American, as long as it doesn't conflict with our laws, which require us to buy the things from China and from other countries. After all, free trade, globalism, protectionism, terrible. Free trade, wonderful. We transfer our manufacturing and our jobs and our wealth overseas. That's what it's all about, but never let the American people know. We've got to keep them in the dark until one day they wake up and find that they're living in a totalitarian state and impoverished condition. We'll be back in just a moment here with Dr. Dennis Cutting, right here at Radio Liberty. Well, Dennis, you go right ahead.
Sure. Yeah, the excuse is, well, free trade, but if you look at it, we've never had free trade. Free trade is two countries can, or any country can trade whatever it wants with anybody else. What we've had is managed trade, and that's what they want to continue, because that's the plan. But anyway, back to this BYD. I'm just using that as an example of what's happening and what's coming down the road. A lot of people look at this economic crisis and say, woe is me, you know, we'll have all these problems, oh, it's horrible, it'll take a year or two, oh, this is awful. What I'm trying to point out here in this article is that this is going to be relatively nothing compared to the future. There's this huge monster coming over the horizon, and most Americans are totally oblivious to it because they're consumed with what I would call temporocentrism, which is the only thing that matters is now. You know, what's happening to me now? They can't be bothered with looking down the road. And so the question I'm trying to point out here is, this BYD company has been around for a long time, but it's only been making cars for about 5 years. So the question is, how could they beat the U.S. with the first mass-produced electric car? And what I'm pointing out here, and this is very important for your listeners, is it's probably because that education in China is far more rigorous than the U.S. And when I say that, your listeners are saying, uh-huh, yeah, more serious, kids don't act up, a little more math, a little science, maybe they go year-round school, uh-huh, got it. No, that's not it. For example, there's a small town in China named Jinzhou. In that town, and this is not atypical, they have a high school, and it has 10,000 students in this one high school. Those youngsters arrive at 6 a.m. for calisthenics, you know, to get the oxygen pumping, the endorphins. They don't leave that school until 10 p.m. at night. That's one example of how serious these people are about education. In China, the high school students take 4 years of biology, 4 years of chemistry, 4 years of physics. And in their senior year, there's an integration of all those subjects. If your listeners will go to the local mall in your town, wherever you are, Monterey, you know, San Francisco, it doesn't matter, and you see some high school kids, ask them, you know, are you taking chemistry and physics? They'll probably say, well, chemistry, yeah, but physics, it's too hard. I'll take biology instead. Or if you do find a youngster who says, yeah, I'm taking it, you say, are you really enthusiastic? Well, no, not really. I'm taking it because I got to, you know, to get into college and the engineering class or whatever. That's the attitude of the typical American high school student.
Hold that thought. We're going to be back in just a moment with Dr. Dennis Cutty right here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is Dr. Cuddy, and he's just been talking about how in China today, they really have a strenuous educational system. The children arrive at 6 o'clock in the morning at the high school, 10,000 students in this one city. They start out doing their calisthenics, then, of course, they're there until 10 o'clock at night. They're really intent upon getting these children way ahead of our children, stressing education. Now, remember, It was the establishment. It was the, what I call the dark side, the Brotherhood of Darkness, that brought communism to China and actually is trying to make it a much more effective society than ours. They're the same people who are in America who've done everything they could to dumb down our children, to take away the incentives, to let our kids, you know, have no discipline, and of course to destroy anybody who suggests we need discipline in America, just as they will destroy anybody who wants to protect America from the imports coming in from countries where they have slave labor. And of course the whole idea is they want to transfer our wealth, they want to transfer our manufacturing, they want to transfer our future to other countries to lower the living standards in America, to raise the living standards in China, and they're going to excel, and our kids are just going to stumble along through college and be pushed all the way out to the far end, but they cannot produce the goods anywhere near as good as they do in China and Japan, because our leaders have no loyalty to America. Their loyalty is to the internationalist dream. And boy, are they succeeding. Go right ahead.
And that's, I'll just break into my own article here. What you just said is extremely important. Because if you look at, let's say, the Rockefellers, there's all kinds of information, including that book, The Second American Revolution, by John D. Rockefeller III, and I think it's 1973. Over and over and over again, decade after decade, the Rockefellers have been basically advocating a sort of cultural liberation, translated into the schools as well, the students' rights, you know, independence, creative, free self-expression. Don't impose too much of a burden. We need to be liberated. You know, we need to, in other words, if you wanted, like when I was teaching in the 60s, and formally we had a nation with schools which had discipline, you know, and rigor and so forth. Well, the Rockefellers and all these progressive types would come in there and say, no, you know, don't be so harsh on these students. Johnny's trying his best he can. You really can't flunk Johnny. He's really trying. Let's have social promotion. Students' rights. Never mind that the rest of the youngsters in the class couldn't learn because one youngster was expressing his, you know, his free self-expression by throwing paper wads or whatever. So in this country, they were all about liberalizing freedom. Don't inhibit the poor child in the school. But then, if you look at Rockefeller David's article in 1973, he's praising Chairman Mao. Now, what does Chairman Mao did? You know, you better stay in line or you're going to be slaughtered, you know.
I remember, he actually, you know, that was 73, between 58 and 70. 58 and 62, Chairman Mao supervised the supervision, the elimination, the planned starvation of between 41 and 44 million people. And this is covered in a book by Stephen Mosier, who speaks fluent Chinese and knew a lot of the leaders over there. Between 41 and 44 million people. How could you conceal something like that from the American people? Now, remember, that is just simply 11 years before David Rockefeller writes there in the New York Times about this wonderful social experiment in China under Chairman Mao, is one of the most important and successful in history. It was all a social experiment. When do we hear about all those Chinese who were intentionally starved to death? Why do we hear about the Holocaust all the time, but never the 100 million people that David Rockefeller's friends in communist China starved to death? It is not simply by coincidence that there's a group of 30, the economists who rule the world, and on that, of course, is Mr. Paulson, who's the senior advisor, economic advisor to President Obama, a man named Timothy Geithner, who's the Secretary of the Treasury, a man named Larry Summers, head of the Council of Economic Advisors, and of course also on the group of 30 is the head of the Chinese National Bank, the Communist Bank in China. I wonder what they talk about and how they laugh when they get together and how foolish the American people are. Incidentally, in the group of 36 of them come from the 86 members or 87 members of the North American chapter of the the Trilateral Commission, but go right ahead.
Okay. So just get this, your listeners, get this image in your head. On the one hand, in this country, the Rockefellers are saying liberation, relaxation, free expression. Let's don't be authoritarian in these schools. But then they turn right around and they look at the authoritarian, brutal dictatorship of Chairman Mao and says, yeah, yeah, that's great. He's doing a great thing over there. Now, you know, is something wrong with that picture? As far as they're concerned, no, that's what they want to do with us, and it's what they want to do with China. Now, back to the education about mathematics. If you look at the American school, once again, you're at this mall, and you're talking to these high school students at your local mall. And they're high school, and you say, what kind of math are you taking? Probably a lot of them will say, well, I'm taking general math in the ninth grade and maybe algebra in the tenth grade, and I don't know, I might even throw in, you know, a year of geometry, but hey, man, you know, that's it. Math is tough, you know, that's it, you know, that's all. Well, in China, they take 4 years of math in high school, 4 years of algebra, 4 years of geometry, 4 years of trigonometry, 4 years of calculus, and they throw in statistics, and every single year they integrate those subjects. In other words, if you're going to build a building, you're going to have a little algebra, a little geometry, a little trig, a little calculus, and so forth. They know that. They understand that obvious fact. So they integrate all subjects. And they teach all of those subjects every single year of the 4 years of high school. Now compare that to the American students. And you will get some slight idea of what the future is going to be for us because we have entered this period of globalization. So it's almost as like the state of California, let's say, is competing against the state of Oregon. And in the state of California, the students only take, you know, geometry and algebra, but the students in Oregon are taking 4 years of trigonometry, 4 years of algebra. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to find out which state is going to win out if there is economic competition. Well, that's what we've entered globally.
Well, of course, the thing is that they have deliberately set out to dumb down our students. The Rockefeller Foundation has funded all of these crazy views of, you know, not teaching the children to read by phonics. Oh, no, sound out the words, you know, and then, of course, not to give them regular mathematics, to give them the modern mathematics and find out how they feel about 2 plus 2. How could you possibly do something this stupid unintentionally? And I would point out, they didn't do it unintentionally. They deliberately dumbed down our students so we could not compete in the world. And why would anybody, rational people, want to do that? Because we're not dealing with rational people. We're dealing with people with an internationalist dream. And, of course, they want to destroy the United States to lower our living standards, and they're in the process of doing that today, taking away their homes, their jobs, their automobiles, and their future and their hope. Go right ahead.
Okay, so now after education, I have to go through school and they enter the workplace. I've already mentioned in previous articles about one town in China that specializes in the manufacture of neckties, which, you know, you may say, oh, neckties, you know, who cares? But the point is what they've done is what we used to do in our factories in terms of specialization, except now they have entire towns doing this. There's another town, Putian. It's the largest shoe manufacturer in the world. That's what that town specializes in. And not only the largest shoe manufacturer in the world, they make one-third of all shoes in the U.S. You go to a shoe store, you look at those shoes, one-third are made in this one town. Not just China. See, the point is it's not just China, it's this one town. They have towns specializing. You know, when the youngster enters, you know, two shoes plus two shoes equals four shoes, they live and breathe shoes. So by the time they get out of school, they know far more than any American youngster is going to know about the manufacture, sale, distribution, promotion, whatever, of shoes or neckties. They will have towns specializing in biomedical technology, nanotechnology, computer integration, and so forth, satellite communication. You know, I mean, they have enough people to have entire towns specialize in this stuff. There is no way in a global economy we're going to be able to compete with those people. That's what I say is this monster coming over the horizon. We've just started to see it with this BYD. Everybody here is amazed. Golly shucks, how in 5 years could this Chinese company come out and beat Detroit? Well, here's one of the answers, and it's only begun. It's only begun. Now, in terms of what I've tried to do, and, you know, I guess this is, say, I'm tooting my own horn or something, but over the years, I've tried to warn people. I won't rehash all of this stuff, but I'll just quickly mention. In terms of elementary and secondary education, I've mentioned several ways about collecting successful teaching methods by, you know, teachers who have tried this and it's worked in their class. No, people don't want to do that. I've told them how to, you know, get a middle-sized, small and large school system with little funds but high scores and then replicate what they're doing, their, you know, success formula. No, they don't want to do that. So now regarding higher education after elementary and secondary, about 30 years ago, what I did, during the Carter years, there was something called a Commission on Foreign Languages and International Studies. And so I wrote up this journal article. I said, look, here's what you do. Because I could see this thing coming. You know, I could see this coming over. I said, why don't you offer what's called contemporary cultures? Now, this isn't some touristy thing. What I said is, what you do is in a course, let's say contemporary China, contemporary India, contemporary whatever. And I actually went to the university and surveyed students in the class, would you like to take, you know, contemporary Australia or whatever? 95% of the hands go up. Yes, 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 yes. The administration, no, we don't, no, whatever. And so what the students would learn in here is an intensive study of the nation's history, geography, the culture, that'd be art and music, the language, the politics, the economics of these individual foreign nations. You wouldn't have to create a whole new department. It would feed into the various departments. It would stimulate interest in foreign languages. You know, people would go out and learn Chinese or German, you know, whatever it is you wanted to focus on. For whatever reason, you know, you had sister city, it doesn't matter. You could have a university system, let's say California, 40 universities, you know, each university could have one area specialization. One could take China, one India, and so forth. The point is, we needed then, it's too late nowadays, we needed then to be, to understand what we were going to come up against in the future. And if you were really looking for these jobs, and this is not an argument for globalization, I think it's a disaster, and I know it's part of the master plan. But the point is, if you were an administrator, and if you were going to try to prepare your youngsters for the future, and if you wanted them to have jobs, let's say in California, who would a company hire? Would it hire a Harvard MBA who just had general knowledge, or would it have somebody who had tremendous expertise coming out of San Jose State or something, who really knew the Nigerian culture? Up one, and they knew the language, they knew the history, they knew the geography. Of course, you would win. Your students would win. They would be the beneficiaries. So anyway, I tried to put that forward. Nah, they couldn't care less. They didn't see what was coming anyway. Now contrast that with what the Chinese are doing today. The Chinese higher institution education, they actually have departments of entrepreneurship. Now, you listen, probably say, entrepreneurship? That's, you know, free enterprise capitalism. What are those commies doing with that? That sounds sort of contradictory. But what you got to realize is that this Rockefeller plan, say David Rockefeller's promotion of China, communist China, over 35 years, the past 35 years, that was not because his idea was for a nation of just a bunch of communal peasants. That's not what he saw. Now, you know, he wants worker bees. But the plan was that rather China would be the fulfillment of Frederick Gates' dream that I mentioned in the first part of this Rockefeller plan. You would have these docile rural folk satisfied with their own lot, led by this educated elite. Now, the elite wouldn't just be a political elite, it would be a technical elite. So on the one hand, you have all these peasant worker bees types. That's true. But it wouldn't just be them. You would also have this technical, educated elite as well. This is the BYD types that can compete. So what it is sort of the old, you know, reference to this feudal idea, which I had projected for the future would be where they were leading us. There's a large rural population in China. So what you have is those people, they move off of the farms, the rice farms and so forth. They moved to the cities like Shanghai, and a friend of mine actually went over there and took some pictures, and he says, okay, you see these big skyscrapers? You know, this is where the technical elite work. You see that in between those two skyscrapers? He said, yeah. He says, those are the hovels that the poor workers live in between the modern skyscrapers. They took a picture of this, two women also. She took a picture of them cutting lawns. I said, what are those two women doing? Well, they're cutting the lawn. Not with, you know, a lawnmower, but with little scissors. See, they have to be satisfied with their lawn. So there you have the two different Chinas side by side. You have the peasant, the farmer, the worker bee types, but you have the skyscraper, which is inhabited by the technical elite. And so what that is a return to the feudalism described in W.J. Gent's work that I mentioned before, and I got my books titled Our Benevolent Feudalism. It was 1902. Jack London, famous author, who was a very, very sympathetic to the communists, by the way, Jack London, in his book, The Iron Heel, which is 5 years later, 1907, proclaimed that that book, Benevolent Feudalism, would be, he said, the textbook that the oligarchs and plutocrats would use in, quote, molding the thought processes of the nation. Now, if you want to see that, at the end of my book, The Road to Socialism and the New World Order, which is carried by Radio Liberty, I quote extensively from Gent's plan, which I projected at the end of my book as resulting in the techno-feudal, socialistic, New Age, New World Order, including this world socialist government. So that appears to be the way we're headed, and I don't know, are we sort of running out of time here, or...
Well, we've got about a minute and a half, and then we'll have a 3 minutes during the break. So go right ahead.
Okay. Well, as I've written before, the way they bring these about in stages is through crises. What they're used for is to get the public into accepting things that they otherwise would really resist.
Are you suggesting that maybe the present financial crisis, which is totally generated, I mean, anybody who hasn't heard my talk on how they simply started paying interest on the reserves held with the Federal Reserve and dried up $5 trillion worth of money that could be loaned or stopped small business loans or how the big banks are really going right along with this whole scam. We lend them all this money and what do? Why, they just refuse to lend it to the corporation. Henry Paulson forgot to tell them when we gave them all the money they were supposed to lend it out. Gee, how could Henry Paulson, who made almost $1 billion as CEO of Goldman Sachs, just be so forgetful? He forgot to tell the banks they were supposed to lend all the money we gave them. Go ahead.
Okay, and like I said, remember, Goldman Sachs is the representative of a lot of Chinese interest here.
Right, and of course they are part of the Trilateral Commission, so go ahead.
Okay, well, in that regard about people accepting things they otherwise would resist, there's an article, Global Economy Hit by Massive Wave of Job Cuts. You can find that in the Economic Times. That's actually out of India, January 26, 2002. And one reads that, quote, British Prime Minister Gordon Brown, and there's a long quote, maybe I better wait for after the break.
All right, fine. Well, ladies and gentlemen, what you're seeing is a carefully stage-managed crisis. A lot of people are going to lose all hope as a result of it. Understand, it's all created, and of course, they will continue. They will destroy America if we give them the opportunity. Dennis, go right ahead.
Okay, so in this article, which is, again, not the New York Times, but the Economic Times, is out of India, here's the quote. British Prime Minister Gordon Brown insisted that the current economic crisis, the global crisis, should ultimately give birth to a new global order. That's what the Prime Minister said. He continued, we could view the threats and challenges we face today as the difficult birth pangs of a new global order. And our task now is nothing less than making the transition through a new internationalism to the benefits of an expanding global society, end quote.
And, of course, what he's really talking about is an elite who will rule the world and the rest of us will be feudal peasants, and they know exactly what they're doing. They just don't want us to know.
Right, and toward that end that he's projecting, the, quote, molding of thought processes that I mentioned earlier is brought about by saying only global solutions can solve these global problems. Now, relevant to that, you have key people in place. There's a fellow named Ben Barber with an outfit called DEMOS, D-E-M-O-S. And that's received hundreds of thousands of dollars from the Rockefeller Foundation. And if you'd looked at the PBS show, Tavis Smiley Show, January 16, 2009, he stated that, quote, the war on terrorism, like the war on drugs, like the war on AIDS, like the war on over-leveraged banks and markets can only be fought together, not one nation at a time. President Obama has a chance to create a shared destiny for an interdependent world in which the United States leads, but also listens, in which the United States is a model for change and democracy, but also learns from others how it's done, end quote. That's what he said. This guy, Barber, has led what's called, quote, Interdependence Day on September 12th every year since 2003, and the host, Tavis Smiley, referred to this fellow as, quote, a great American public intellectual. So it's efforts like those of Demos and Barber which are going to help bring about the fruition of the Rockefeller One World Plan. And the movement towards socialism in the U.S. will be an important part of this. And so what I next refer to in my column as concerning that movement is Dick Morris's column titled The Obama Presidency, Here Comes Socialism. And you can see that on Morris's website, January 20, 2009. And he wrote, well, this is again a long quote. Maybe I should say that till next time too, if you want to have a summary statement.
Well, I'll tell you what, we'll have you back next week, and we'll cover that at that time. Of course, our guest has been Dr. Dennis Cuddy. We've been talking about the move towards the one world feudal society that is being, of course, created and financed by our leading aristocracy. Bye bye. God bless.
God bless you too.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and what you must understand is there is a drive for a one-world government with a ruling aristocracy, a feudalistic system. Professor Quigley wrote about that, of course, on page 324 of his book, Tragedy and Hope. If you haven't read it, you need to get it. And, of course, or you can get it in my little pamphlet entitled The History of Money, Which You Should Know. But basically, he simply says that the central banks of the world, of course, which represent the interests of our feudal elite, hold regular meetings, in his words, hold regular meetings, secret meetings, where they plan on bringing about a world feudal system. This is what it's about. And that's why, of course, they've artificially collapsed our economy. That is why Mr. Paulson absolutely refused to do anything to stop the cascade of collapse of the housing market. Why? Because they didn't want to stop the collapse. If they stopped the collapse, they would stop the collapse of the world economy. They wanted to progress. They want to have people lose their homes. They want to have people lose their businesses and their factories. They want to impoverish people all throughout the world. And out of the desperation that develops will come about this new world order. And if you doubt that, you need to get Henry Kissinger's article, International Herald Tribune, 12th of January, 2009, entitled The Chance for a New World Order. If you don't have access to the Internet, you can call us. We'll send you the article. We hope that you'll want to get certainly the three newsletters we've done so far on that, November, December, and January of November, December 2008, January 2009, where we, of course, go into the background of how they've staged this entire plan. We're learning new things all the world time, where they actually, you know, they stopped issuing letters of credit to cut down and make it extremely difficult to have international trade. They want to collapse the system and bring about a one-world government of serfs who will work in their world government. You need to read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. That's Brotherhood of Darkness. You need, of course, to read the book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, published in 1966. And immediately, of course, the press, somebody came in and bought up Macmillan and destroyed the place to the first half of the book so it couldn't be reprinted. And we have an interview with the author, Professor Carol Quigley, where he tells that. We got this interview back at Georgetown University back in 1980 when I was there, and I purchased the right to use that from the, Professor Quigley's widow. Or you can get the Tragedy and Hope special with another book that's been suppressed, Foundations, Their Power and Influence. You get Tragedy and Hope, and you get the interview with Professor Quigley where he tells how his book was suppressed. That's called the Tragedy and Hope Special. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Because we are under attack from within by a small cabal that wants to enslave our people. There's only about 87 of them at the upper echelons here in the North American chapter, Americans, I should say, in the North American chapter of the Trilateral Commission. You can check out what I say by going to augustreview.org and get the list of the Trilateral Commission members, or you can go to the trilateral.org, and there's a place there where they will, you just email them, they'll send you the membership list. How could this go on and we wouldn't know about it? Well, we have freedom of the press. And they own the press. They have the freedom to suppress the information. Of course, you need to get my talk on the forbidden secret to understand the spiritual forces that energize these wicked people. You need to go to the Trilateral Commission website, trilateral.org, and look at their logo. And if you look very carefully, you may see the three sixes. If not, why, you'll certainly see the upside-down broken cross in the center. An ancient the symbol of the ancient mystery religions, because we're seeing today the fulfillment of the ancient plan to bring about a one-world government, a one-world financial system, a one-world religion, and install the coming world leader. You need to get our DVD sets, Pastor Crone, on the final countdown, all available by calling 1-800-544-8927. And then please talk to others. Try to get them to listen to our programs and go to our website. You can hear us there at RadioLiberty.com 9 hours a day.